Good evening, everyone. Many familiar faces. Welcome, everyone. My name is Peter Vols, and I'll be helping teach this class along with my dear friend and colleague, Clark Warren. Clark, raise your hand, Clark. And Sherab Chudzinkon will also be helping us toward the end. This is the first of 12 talks, 12 classes. We will also be joined, besides Clark and Sherab, we will be joined by Robert Spellman, who's a professor at Naropa University. He'll teach on Dharma art a little bit later in the course. Our approach here will be pretty open, and this is sort of exploration together. The people worked on this class don't by any means think that we have some kind of comprehensive or definitive take on this. This class could be taught 1,000 times and it would be different every time, and there would be something worthwhile in it every time. There's enough there. So we just took a few things that we thought were relevant and interesting, a few topics and themes, and we kind of wove them together into what we hope is a somewhat comprehensive or cohesive whole. We think that the topics that we have selected and the themes that were interesting to us in the early 1970s are interesting now and were probably interesting at the time of the Buddha. We'll see. They're somewhat timeless, I think, for anyone interested in exploring what it means to be a human. So, if you look at your syllabus, you will see that tonight's talk, the title of which is a little frightening, The Who, What, How, When, Where of Vidyadhara the Venerable Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. I disavow any knowledge of the title of this talk or had any part in making it. I have no idea who he was, barely know what he did or how he did it. Vaguely know when he did it. I don't really know where he did it. So let's scrap the title of the talk. I think, Clark, you came up with the title of the talk, didn't you? I hate to point fingers, but... And we'll just jump in here and get going. I first met Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche in late May of 1973. I had graduated from UC Berkeley in the San Francisco Bay Area and lived there a year before that. I was a crazed, I would say, maybe dazed is a better word, hippie, with some alleged spiritual interest, mainly of the Hindu ilk, although I also dabbled in Zen Buddhism. But I found their hours were way too early. They were way too serious. Their hair was way too short. I didn't really feel at home. But I love the teachings, and I still do. But culturally, it didn't quite work for me. And I was confirmed in that feeling one morning when I got up at some ungodly hour for me, 5 a.m. or something, and was riding my bike furiously. I was late, of course, to the morning sitting, and to be late could be fatal, as far as I could tell. And I was really going fast down the street in a bad part of Berkeley, where the center still is. Actually, same center. This was 1971 or 72. And I looked up and there was a shopping cart about 3 feet in front of me. I was going about 20 miles an hour. So that, I took that as a message that I would at least delay my interest in Zen Buddhism for a while. Anyway, I worked at a natural food store, and I had a friend there named Arthur Borden, who actually just died recently. And Arthur and I became buddies, and we talked about spiritual stuff. And one day he said, "You have to come this weekend. There's a Tibetan teacher who's teaching." And I was rather cynical at that point. I had gone through a lot of various ins and outs and was not really interested. But I liked Arthur, so I kind of humored him, and I had hoped that he would forget the invitation, but he didn't. So several times he reminded me and said, "You have to see this guy." I said, "Yeah, okay, Arthur, sure, I'll try to make it." And he said, "But you, these stories that from Los Angeles, where he's been recently." I said, "What stories?" And he said, "Well, he plays Monopoly with his students. He drinks. He even smokes." My ears started to perk up a little bit. This was a little bit more my style, I think, at the time. Anyway, Arthur convinced me to go, and I will be eternally grateful to Arthur for the rest of this life and all my future lives. And I went to a talk. It was at a Unitarian church on Geary in San Francisco, still there. I was raised a Unitarian, so I thought that was mildly interesting. I was 23 at the time, and Trungpa Rinpoche was 34 at the time. And when he walked onto the stage, I was struck and kind of physically sat up straighter and started to pay attention. And between the time he stepped onto the stage and the time he sat down, I had sort of, things had been altered rather significantly, it seemed. It was his, I think, simplicity and steadiness. Later, I'd heard about, sometimes Tibetans talk about a walk of an elephant. Very steady, always the same. And great teachers that I've encountered since that time often have a walk of an elephant. No hurry. Same speed. Not excited, not down, steady. He was like that. And I have no idea what he talked about that night, but I remember him being funny, not ponderous, not serious, not religious, not abstract, not theoretical. And I was quite intrigued. I had a chance to meet him and have an interview because I happened to know the guy standing in front of the door at the time. I can't remember at all what we talked about, but I do remember that he was human. And the conversation was eye level. It was not some lofty guru, as I had thought of gurus. So anyway, I started, there was a local center there at that time called Dharmadhatu. There was one in Berkeley, San Francisco, various places. I lived in Berkeley, so I started going to the Berkeley Dharmadhatu. And one night there was a talk by someone who actually still lives in town, Max King was his name. And Max gave a lovely little talk, and at one point he quoted the Buddha. This is from a sutra. I'm sure Cher Clark would know the name of the sutra. But basically the Buddha is talking to his disciples, and he says, "Don't believe me. Don't believe what I'm telling you. Don't accept it. Don't swallow it. Think for yourself. Does it make sense? Think again. Does it really make sense? Does it apply to my life? Don't believe me." And I'm thinking to myself, this is a strange religion. They're telling you not to believe what they're telling you. But I found it extremely interesting that that was the point of the talk. And I'm grateful to Max that the way he did it was very good. And just recently I was reminded of this because I was with a friend and she was telling me about the first time she met Trungpa Rinpoche, and her sister was already involved in the community. And her sister made this big deal about her introducing her to Trungpa Rinpoche and set up this meeting, and it was a very big deal. And she was very nervous, and her sister was being kind of pompous about it. And so she kind of doesn't know what to do. She doesn't know the protocol, so she kind of goes up to Rinpoche. And he looks at her. He kind of makes her come up and looks at her. And he looks at her. The very first thing he said to her was, "Don't buy it." And it was kind of a comment on her sister and on the whole thing. And she said, to this day, she thinks about that teaching. Don't buy it. So anyway, that was all of that kind of approach of no dogma, nothing to believe, nothing to swallow, no blind faith. Use your mind, use your heart. That I found that extremely interesting and helpful. and pulled me in further. So I practiced with the community for several years in Berkeley, and finally moved here to Boulder to be closer to Rinpoche and the community in 1977, and got involved in various projects here and actually worked in this building for a number of years, and worked in what we called external affairs or international affairs, which was relations with other Tibetan teachers. We helped host the Dalai Lama and other prominent Tibetan teachers, and some of whom had diplomatic passports, so we had to deal with the U.S. government, State Department. So it was a little mini State Department within Shambhala. And we did a lot of interesting, fun things. We actually hosted the Chinese ambassador here at one point. And maybe it's too early for this story, but it's a funny story. Trungpa Rinpoche was very excited about the Chinese ambassador coming. This was about 1985. And he was, for several days, he was sort of very excited about him coming, seemingly. And he would get dressed a day or two before he was supposed to arrive. And he was a little bit otherworldly at that stage. And functioning and talking, but something else going on at the same time. So anyway, the Chinese ambassador shows up. Big reception, very fancy, receiving line, kind of. We kind of did it in a diplomatic format. And the ambassador comes in, and Trungpa Rinpoche had a sitting room right to the right when they came in the house. He sat down in this, like a green room in this case. And the ambassador turned to Rinpoche and said, "So, Rinpoche, how long have you lived in Boulder?" And Rinpoche looked him straight in the eye and said, "Fine, thank you. How are you?" And the conversation kind of deteriorated from there. But it was a very successful reception. And we had somebody, a driver for him, who knew Chinese. But we didn't tell them he knew Chinese, so we kind of... It was fun. So anyway, our office would work on that kind of thing. I did that for a number of years. And... yeah, so I've been a student of Rinpoche since that time, late May of 1973, and I still consider myself a student of his, and although he seemingly and allegedly died, I have my doubts about what that really means. Something died, but something didn't. Trungpa Rinpoche was born... It's a little uncertain, but officially he was born in 1939 in a remote part of a very remote country. Think of Tibet, you think of Lhasa. Lhasa's like a relatively big city. This was about 2 months, as the Tibetans always talk about time, not distance, 2 months east of Lhasa, almost into the middle of China. Tibet geographically is so huge. This was in the pretty far east. And I was there once, and it's very, very beautiful country. There's no trees. There's hardly even any shrubs. Very, very stark in a certain way. And there's a lot of nomads. Beautiful green hills. In the spring, it rains. Anyway, Rinpoche was born there in 1939. And as a very young age, like a baby, like, I don't know exactly, two, I think, or three, he was recognized as a tulku, or an incarnate lama in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And I don't think we want to get into that tonight, but we can talk more later about that if we want. And was enthroned a couple years after that as the incarnation of a very important line of Tibetan teachers, and was seated within a monastery in that area. And began his training, which was extremely rigorous and thorough. He had mentors and tutors and gurus and teachers. And by all accounts, he was an extremely diligent student and a brilliant student, learned quickly, learned well. He had to memorize many, many pages of text. Sometimes overnight, they'd have to do 20 pages overnight. And this is not easy stuff. This is really challenging. And he had to contemplate on the meaning and meditate on the meaning meaning of the words of what he was learning. And his teachers were very old school. There was physical discipline involved. And he was thoroughly trained. When he was about 14, he led a ceremony for a large group of people that went on for 3 months and which had thousands of subparts to it. And apparently he did it impeccably. And people in the area and his teachers and mentors were astounded that he could actually know how to do it. They were very nervous that he wouldn't make a good showing and embarrass the monastery. But apparently he did it extremely well. He also, as part of his training, it's quite interesting. Lamas in Tibetan culture are always called out when people are dying. And the faith is so strong with people, they really want to be able to be with a teacher, a lama. And so he spent many, many hours, day and night for years, sitting and relating to people as they were dying. It was part of his training. And he understood the process of what that was, what people went through, the stages of it. During this time, the Chinese were moving into Tibet, and it was over a number of years. It started about 1950. And they came first as friendly helpers. But slowly it became very clear to people that they were not friendly and they were not helping. And they didn't like Tibetan culture, and they definitely didn't like Tibetan Buddhism. And it became obvious that the situation wasn't tenable. And after much back and forth, Trungpa Rinpoche and about 300 people from the area left Tibet. And the only, as far as I can tell, I could be wrong on this, but the only thing they knew was to go south, because India was south, and a little bit west, maybe. But that, other than that, they had no maps. And they would get to places, and so there was a group of 300 moving out of Tibet toward India, being pursued at times by Chinese, at times from several directions. The Chinese knew they were generally where they were honing in on them. They would lay low in the day and travel at night. They ran out of food. It took them 10 months. They left in March of 1959, and they got into Northeast India in January of 1960. So it's a very arduous trip. At one point, they boiled their shoes for broth. And when they got there, I don't know the exact number, but the 300 had become like 25 people. And he wrote a book about it. It was a very moving book, partly because there's very little dramatic tone to it or emotion to it, called Born in Tibet. It's still a great read. After it was written in 1966. Still a wonderful book, very interesting. And he lived in India for several years. The Dalai Lama asked him to be the head of an important school for training young teachers, and he did that for several years. And then he clearly was drawn to the West, even before he left Tibet. He was interested in the West. And he got a scholarship to go to Oxford, studied there, and studied Western art and philosophy, and was very diligent with English. And eventually started a Buddhist center in Scotland, which still goes on today. And he took his robes off. He was a very, very strict and very good monk up to that time. But in England, he met a young British woman, very young, 16. And he married her. First he derobed, and then he married her. And that was scandalous on many levels, on both sides of the family. And his side of the family included a lot of people, like the Dalai Lama. So that was a little tricky. But the point of him doing it, as he later explained it, was really to communicate. He felt like the robes, people in the West had a kind of fascination with the exoticism of this foreign culture, and that that created a tremendous boundary between the students and the teacher, and that that boundary couldn't be broken down. In his case, he felt without just kind of melting into the culture rather than staying on a high throne above the culture. We'll talk more about that. But at that time, and I think it's after he met his wife-to-be, but before he got married, he had a very, very serious car accident. And he talks about that in the prologue of, or the afterword of Born in Tibet, where he talks about what that car accident did and what was going on. But basically, for him, it was kind of a wake-up that he needed to connect directly and without barrier or without artifice with students and with the culture he was in. And it crippled him. Half of his body was paralyzed, semi-paralyzed, and he walked with a limp for the rest of his life after the accident. It was very nearly killed. In 1970, so he was headed to America, North America. And Scotland in some way was a stopping, and UK was a stop-off on his way. In 1970, he got a visa, but his visa didn't come through for about 2 or 3 months. And during that time, he lived in Montreal with his wife, just the two of them in a little apartment, a little basement apartment. They had no money. They would buy bread and peanut butter for 2 or 3 months while they waited for their visa. Finally, the visa came through, and they were headed toward Vermont, where someone had given them a farm, and Rinpoche started a Dharma center there. And shortly thereafter, he came here. I think Clark was here at that time. He was invited by professors at CU. We can talk more about that. I don't know that history too well. And he started teaching here and gathered a lot of students, and people were very interested. And he traveled a lot around the states, established a network of centers, almost all of which are still functioning and active. And he started Naropa University and Shambhala Training, all kinds of different entities for teaching Dharma. And in 1987, he died in Nova Scotia. And shortly thereafter, a couple of years after that, his son took over the organization, Sakyong Mipham Rinpoche, who continues now to be in charge of the Shambhala community that he founded. So that's the thumbnail. We can get into it more as we go along. There's a lot of detail, but Born in Tibet is a wonderful resource for this period, for sort of the overview of his life. Are there any questions? All right. Feel free to jump in if you have questions. We don't have to be too formal about this as we go along. This course is being taped and will be replayed online through the project that's coordinated out of Nova Scotia called like Chronicles of Chogyam Trungpa, and I'll give you that information. But I think they're going to do one talk a month after we do the course. So the reason I mention that is because we need to record our questions when you ask questions. Okay. I thought I would just briefly introduce the main themes that we'll be exploring together during this course. And we selected these because we feel like they're critical or central to what it is Rinpoche was doing during his time in the West, and that they were not, they're not time-bound, and they weren't for a particular era when we were all drug-addled hippies. That actually what he was teaching, these things that he was teaching in 1972, 73, 74, and beyond, are fundamental to following any spiritual path, and in fact are very traditional and go back centuries and centuries of what teachers have taught and what need to be considered as we trod a path, as we try to trod a path. And Rinpoche would continually, there was a kind of warning going on a lot of the time that the spiritual path was not simple. It was not obvious. It was actually a very subtle process, and that there were a lot of ways to go astray. You could say, maybe it's a simplistic analogy, but or you could say something like, it's like if you flew to India and went to the jungles in Arunachal Pradesh in extreme northeastern India, where a little bit east of there there's still cannibals, supposedly, in Nagaland. And you were needed to get through a jungle to get to a destination. And you had no knowledge of the terrain particularly, or a very vague sense of it. And you had to launch out, and you had to get through it. It would be extremely important to have a guide who's been through that terrain. So in the Buddhist tradition, the spiritual teacher has a lot of different roles. But one of them is a guide like that, to help students understand and traverse the spiritual path. Because it might seem easy, or it might seem like, oh, you just do this, this, and this, you just follow instructions. But it's a very, very subtle process, and it's very easy to be confused and a little bit led astray. So one of the main ways that one can be led astray and be confused is what Trungpa Rinpoche called spiritual materialism. And I don't know, but I think he coined the term. Is that right? I think so. I've never heard of anyone having used it before. People now use it. Other Buddhist teachers use it fairly regularly. But spiritual materialism, he felt, was a major obstacle, not just for Westerners. Sometimes we have this very romantic idea that people in the East, wherever the hell that is, have some natural affinity to. And sure, it's in their culture, and sure, there is something. But humans share common ground on this one, I think. Anyway, His definition of spiritual materialism was basically that we lose track of the fact that wisdom is innate. Wisdom is natural. We're born with it. We couldn't get rid of it if we worked our whole lives to get rid of it. And we can't acquire something that we'd already have. That's nonsense. It's silly. But we take our habit of mind that we approach our normal life with, and we apply it to the spiritual path, and we think that we are poor and poverty-stricken and lacking. And if we could just gain the right things, then we'll attain some kind of enlightenment. And he considered that a natural, in the sense of a normal and understandable obstacle, but something that really had to be confronted and understood, and really go into it and think about it. There's a wonderful Tibetan parable about a very poor Tibetan family lived out in the wilds, and they had almost nothing. They barely had a house, a hut. It had holes in the roof and light coming through the walls. Very cold, very uncomfortable, and they were miserable people because they were so poor. And eventually the family died, and another family took over the house. And this family decided to renovate the house. So in doing so, they discovered a huge cache of gold that at some previous time had been deposited under the floor of the house. And basically what the story is about is that the people weren't poor. They thought they were poor, and they spent their life trying to get out of being poor, but in fact they were always rich. And the point is that we're all like that. We all have gold under our floor all the time, from the beginning, at birth. So spiritual materialism is thinking we don't have any gold. But if we just do the certain things, we can acquire the gold. So we search for the gold. And in doing so, we distort and confuse ourselves and get sidetracked. There's a wonderful Zen teacher named Suzuki Roshi, who Trungpa Rinpoche was very close to. He died when he was, in 1971, he died. He was in charge of a Zen center in San Francisco, and a seminal Zen teacher, Buddhist teacher in the West. And the way he talked about this, he basically the exact same thing, but the language he used was that one needed to practice without a gaining idea. We sit down on our cushion, we study the teachings, thinking that there's something we have to gain. And he said that's a fundamental mistake. And you never will get you never get going if you think there is something to gain. So that's spiritual materialism. Is there something to gain? Now, of course, we have to practice. And of course, there's all kinds of things we have to do if we are serious about exploring ourselves and the path. But if we don't resolve this issue of spiritual materialism, we're always going to be a little bit cockeyed, a few degrees off. And I was talking to Clark last night. He reminded me that, in fact, we're always working with spiritual materialism, all of us, till the very end, whatever the heck that means. Because we still, and it gets more and more refined, more and more subtle, more and more kind of rarefied. But they say even very accomplished practitioners who've been done four three-year retreats, still, and achieved and accomplished a lot, still, there's a little distance, a tiny distance between themselves and wisdom. Still. So until you resolve the whole issue, there's always some spiritual materialism. But I think what happens is it becomes gross at first, and then it just slowly gets... But if you don't understand what's happening, you can't actually traverse the path. So he drove home this issue of spiritual materialism relentlessly. And not just at the beginning. It was always there. That we needed a clear-headed, realistic, not naive view of what it means to practice Buddhism in the path, follow the path. And that's kind of hard-earned and requires a lot of self-examination and honesty about what you're really doing. One time I was sitting on my bed in my house. My younger daughter was maybe 7 or 8. And I have sort of I heard this from England, Otto Rinpoche, who was a family person. And he said he always had an open door policy in his household. When he practiced, the door was always open. He would never close himself off. So I thought that sounded good, so I always practiced with the door open. My daughter came in, she sat down on my bed, and she sat there for a while, and she looked at me and said, "What are you trying to do?" It was like, right. Thank you. So it's very, you know, I was sitting there thinking I was meditating. Then my 7-year-old, who knew nothing about it supposedly, could see that it wasn't quite that simple or clean. So spiritual materialism, it will be a recurring theme. And a lot of what we study, it's interesting, if you look at the syllabus of this class, a lot of it is related to spiritual materialism. We'll keep getting back to it. It's a fundamental theme. The second theme and thread that will go through the class is the idea of lineage and devotion, and in particular, non-theistic devotion, which I don't want to dare open that can of worms right now, but what it means to be non-theistically devoted to a teacher. But we'll explore that. But in terms of lineage, Most Buddhist schools, I think every Buddhist school, places a lot of emphasis on the teacher. There's different styles to it, there's different ways they go about it, but the teacher is critical in Buddhism. And it's wonderful in some way because it's really a very human tradition. It's passed on from person to person, from human to human, just face to face, working with each other. And one way it's talked about is fresh bread, that had the recipes passed down through the generations, but each generation makes their own bread. And the climatic conditions are different, the cultural conditions are different. It might be flat bread, it might be all kinds of different kinds of bread, but the basic recipe is inherited, and then it's brought fresh. So Buddhism, one reason Buddhism has spread at one point through almost the entire non-Western world, as far west as current Iran, and down into Indonesia, to Mongolia, to Russia, where it's still practiced in Russia, in the far eastern Russia. One reason it spread so much is that it was extremely flexible that way. The bread recipe could always be adapted. There wasn't a cultural imprint that needed to be reproduced in another country. And the way that recipe is passed on is through the teacher to the student. And they say it goes back to the Buddha. The Buddha had students, those students had students, and we are here in this room right now because of that. And Trungpa Rinpoche would talk about his teachers a lot, and a huge percentage of his early seminars and teachings were about lineage and Buddhist teachers and what devotion was and what it meant to have a teacher. And sometimes when he talked about his teachers, he would cry. And it was very moving. You could tell that he, in a very, very deep place, he still loved them as much as he ever loved anything and had a kind of longing for them. In a strange way, because in some way he didn't need them on paper. He realized what they had taught him. They gave him their stamp of approval. But still, he never got over it. And the word in Tibetan for devotion is mugu. It's two words. One means humbleness and one means longing. For Tibetans, it's a combination of longing and humbleness. It's appreciation for how much your teacher has cared for you and that it's not about you. So lineage is really critical, and Tibetans in particular, more than I think any other school, the teacher issue is, and devotion to a teacher, and what devotion really is, not in a stupid way or a blind way, but intelligent, creative way. The Tibetans really emphasize that a lot, and we'll talk more about that. The third theme that we'll follow through this course is the way that Trungpa Rinpoche talked about meditation, the way he taught meditation. Very interesting, very distinctive, and not like other teachers, for the most part. There was a teacher at Naropa University here in town who developed a course that she taught at Naropa for several years, and I love the title of it. The title of her course was Meditation, the Awful Truth. And I think that's, it's sort of silly in some way, but Trungpa Rinpoche, the way he taught meditation was that it was not in any way an escape. There was no place that one was going to go to feel more calm, more happy, more peaceful. In the course of doing it, one might feel more calm and happy and peaceful. Sure, that could be the case. But to try to be more calm or peaceful or happy was another trick and related to spiritual materialism again. So the idea was to simply experience, at least at the beginning, just simply experience the raw emotion and thoughts, and in some ways the utter chaos of our minds. If one's honest with oneself, if one could actually see a transcript of what goes through one's mind in an hour of sitting, I don't know how anyone could be arrogant for the rest of their lives. It's frightening. So his approach was that none of that is bad. None of what arises in the mind is bad. And it's not particularly good either. That those categories are unnecessary. That good experiences can be obstacles. Bad experiences can be real moments of learning and opening. So the idea was to work with one's mind. Not manipulate one's mind. Not pretend. Not hope. Not fear. Not struggle. Not fiddle. But work with. Relate to directly. And in some way, you could say that if someone was to ask, and I've been asked this, kind of the elevator speech, what's the point of Buddhism? One of my father's friends asked me this at a cocktail party one time. He was highly skeptical that I could come up with any plausible answer to the question. But if someone was to ask me the elevator speech, the 10-second speech, or explanation of Buddhism, what's the point? I would say it's to see clearly what is. And some of that's all we ever do. It's not adding something that isn't there. It's not subtracting some bad things that are there. It's actually just seeing clearly. And that we have, Trungpa Rinpoche taught that we have the basic stuff to do that. We have what we need right now. It's natural to us. We don't have to. We can refine it, we can work on it, we can let it mature and ripen, but the basic stuff we have. There's a very funny and strange Tibetan story about a guy who gets his head stuck in bars at the bottom of a monastery. Sometimes there's these metal bars, the way monasteries are built. And this funny guy had somehow gone in to look for something, and he got his head completely stuck inside these metal bars. And a crowd had gathered and were completely freaking out. The poor guy was distraught. He was stuck. He was claustrophobic. He was panicking. And this big crowd had gathered to try to get him out, and they couldn't just pull him out. It wasn't that simple. He was really stuck. And a lama came by, and they all went, "Lama," said, what do we do? The lama looked at him and he said, "Just tell the guy to do the exact opposite of what he did to get in there." So meditation is a little it's a little bit of undoing, but it's understanding how you got to and how you continue to be confused. It's not like ancient history. We do it constantly. We reconfuse ourselves constantly. So anyway, one of the ways that Rinpoche talked about meditation, and I find this an extremely helpful three-word instruction about how to meditate. He said, it's touch and go. Touch is you actually experience yourself and your mind and your emotions and what's around you and everything. You touch it, but you don't hold it. So the go is you don't grasp it. If there's just go, you're avoiding reality. If there's just touch, you're going to really drive yourself nuts and be neurotic. So touch and go. Very practical, very profound way of teaching meditation. So we'll talk more about meditation. We'll see a video of him teaching meditation, I think in class 6, early November. It's wonderful teaching. We'll show us a video. The fourth theme that we will get into, and this isn't really in the syllabus, but I think it's something that will come up and that I think is important, and that makes Rinpoche some stand apart from other teachers, many other teachers, is that he really, genuinely, and deeply trusted his students. And that may sound simple or obvious or duh. Who wouldn't trust their students? But it wasn't that simple. He treated us like adults. A lot of Buddhist teachers, the cultural gap between the countries that Buddhist teachers have come from and Western culture is really significant, I think. There are a lot of Tibetan teachers, and I hope none of them ever hear this tape, but there's a lot of them who really, to this day, don't think Westerners are capable of understanding the most profound teachings of their tradition. That's not unusual, that's common. And maybe it's slowly working its way through the system as we get more, something happens, I don't know. But from the very beginning, Trungpa Rinpoche saw that Americans and Westerners could absolutely understand the most profound teachings. They were capable, and he went for it. And he saw, you know, he was the least naive human being I've ever encountered. He saw it all. He saw the good, the bad, the very ugly, the very silly, the very indulgent, the very neurotic, the very confused. But the amazing thing is that he would, in seeing that, he wouldn't judge. He actually saw that all of that has wisdom. That what we call neurosis is wisdom that's just twisted a little bit. It's our intelligence has been hijacked temporarily by our confusion. But it actually shines through all the time. And he could see that shining through, and he was skillful enough to know how to deal with. So we'll talk more about that. But to me, it's a very significant part of who he was, and I think why he was so successful, and that his teachings endure and are still relevant. And the other side of that is that he didn't hold himself aloft. He didn't sit up on the big shrine, or big throne. Sometimes he would for certain ceremonial reasons, but for the most part, he was right down in the trenches with his students. He took his robes off, and then he took his clothes off, and then he took everything off. And he invited his students to do the same. But he was all there. And he would share his sadness. He would share his own confusion. He had his own journey. He didn't know everything. He didn't know how to do everything. And although he had tremendous skill, it was not simple. And he was a human. I saw him cry. I saw him be in love. I saw him get his heart broken. I saw him get frustrated, angry. He didn't hide it. He didn't try to hold himself up as some special person. I am a Tibetan Lama. I'm impervious. I don't... And then he goes in the back room and starts screaming at people. He wasn't like that. He would scream at people in public and in private sometimes if they needed to be screamed at. A great place to see this, and I would highly recommend it, a great place to get a glimpse of what I'm talking about here is in his poetry. There's a book called First Thought, Best Thought. and Timely Rain are two books of poetry. And really worth, you can get them on Amazon, they're in print. And very revealing stuff in there. And on an organizational level, he really trusted his students to take responsibility, to make mistakes, but be creative, use their inspiration. And he accomplished a great deal, and he put a lot of trust in them. We hosted the Dalai Lama here in 1981. It was a big deal, working with State Department, police departments, all this whole big thing. And he basically, you know, he didn't micromanage it. He let us learn, and he did that in a lot of different areas. Naropa University, he thought the way, and having his students teach also, that's something Tibetan teachers thought was utterly bizarre. How could you have these people start teaching? But he had people teach very early, and I think he saw that that's how they would learn, and he wanted to kind of get the spark going. Anyway, so that's the fourth one. The fifth theme is engaging with the world. And Trungpa Rinpoche's approach was not to become great meditators and Olympic-level meditators. His point was become a decent, sane human being and help the world. Engage with the world. Melt into the world. Don't shy away from the world. In whatever way you can, go for it. And he did a lot himself to kind of get projects going and to do that. And he liked to partner with people and forge sort of alliances and cooperative projects. It was not isolated or inward-looking. He thought it was critical that a Buddhist community be engaged. Finally, and this is something that maybe will help us as we're trying to understand over the next few weeks what the heck was going on, who the hell he was. I think one thing, a theme to come back to, I think, is communication. I think that's what, it won't answer questions, but it will help fill out the picture. So why the heck did he do this? What was he doing when he was doing this? What was going on? If you think communication, how was he communicating? In what way would this be a way to communicate? That sometimes that can be very helpful in trying to make a little bit of sense of all of this. This was a man who was born and raised in an extremely remote part of the most remote country in the world. When he left Tibet, he was about 19 or something, 20. At that point, he had met maybe a few Chinese political operatives and military people who had come to his monastery that were different from his own culture. So it's like being raised in Nebraska on a farm but never leaving the farm. And you would think, well, it's not a very sophisticated person. They're not going to get along in New York. They don't even know what to do in L.A. They're not going to really be very successful. Really, really isolated culturally. And yet, his whole life, he somehow was able to get out of his own ethnocentricity. He wasn't ethnocentric. And most of us are. I don't know if anyone's tried to live overseas. It's not easy, and it's not easy because culturally, it's very hard to get out of your own comfort zone. I used to teach at Naropa University a little bit. I taught intercultural communication as preparation for students to go abroad, and we used to play this card game, a very interesting game called Barnga. And what you do is you hand out rules to groups of people, and they start playing cards. In like subgroups, you have a group, you have like six in a group, so you have three or four groups in a class. They start playing cards. The first round, it's pretty straightforward. And then if you're watching, you see the body language starts to get tense. Then people start slapping their hands on the table in front of them, getting angry. They can't talk, is one of the things in this game. There's no verbal communication allowed. And then people get really heated. Well, it turns out that when you hand out instructions, they're slightly different for everybody. And it's a wonderful game because it's actually the emotion you feel is what actually happens when you go to another culture and you're more than just a tourist. It's like, wait a second, these people aren't playing by the... And when we're just in our own culture, it's like the guys playing poker, right? Everybody knows the rules. You don't sit around and talk about the rules of poker. You play poker, you enjoy it. In our culture, we just sit and everybody knows it. You know, we know what the rules of the game are, and we play them. And it's so deeply ingrained, we don't even have to think about the rules of the game until you leave the farm. And Trungpa Rinpoche was on a very remote farm and was thrown into India, England, Montreal, New York City, and was completely a fish in water while doing it. And I've traveled some, and I've dealt with this. It's unbelievable to me, his level, his ability to communicate and to cross cultures. Because he wasn't just sitting there lecturing. He was going deep into human beings, with human beings. And people are very tainted and colored and shaped by their culture. And you can't understand them if you don't. You can't work with them if you don't know what that is. So anyway, that's his ability to communicate and to cross cultures, to me, was one of his most interesting and remarkable qualities. And it explains a lot. I mean, he studied English diligently. He didn't just kind of get proficient and get by. He really studied it, and his vocabulary is incredible. He studied Western art, Western customs, Western food, all aspects of Western culture. And he didn't do it out of idle curiosity, although I'm sure he was curious, but it was to work with people. And you can't work with people if you don't understand who they are and where they're coming from. I was actually, the last final story here, I was with him one time in India, New Delhi, India. We had gone to a funeral of a Buddhist teacher in India. And we were on our way out of the country. We had one night, and we had dinner, and we were walking around the hotel. And it was wedding season in New Delhi. And they have these big, fancy weddings at this hotel. And it was a huge gathering of people. And it was a Brahmin priest. And Rinpoche stopped, and he was looking at this wedding ceremony. And he really engaged, like, not fascinated, but like he couldn't take his eyes off of it. He didn't say anything. He just stood there. Finally, he was there so long, we got him a chair. So he sat down in the chair. And we're kind of like, and it's kind of interesting for 10, 15, 20 minutes. It was a half hour, 45 minutes, an hour. We start taking shifts. And he was just watching. They invited him down at one point, and he was talking to the priest. 2 hours. So his curiosity, his cultural curiosity was extraordinary. You know, he's not going to teach the Hindus anything. That wasn't his point. But he was just struck by their, maybe the beauty and the quality of the ceremony. Anyway. Those are some of the themes that we will touch on. Probably if Clark had done this, or Sherub, they would have come up with a different list of the themes, but I think we will cover some of these. So if there's any discussion or questions or anything. All right, end of discussion. Anyone ever see the movie What About Bob? Richard Dreyfuss? Very funny movie. Bill Murray's this extremely neurotic guy who taunts and harasses Richard Dreyfuss till he goes insane. But at one point, Richard Dreyfuss, very pompous psychotherapist, calls a family meeting. He goes, family meeting, family meeting. His kids and his wife come. He says, we're going to do this, and we're going to do that, and we're going to do this. No discussion. End of family meeting. I still have family meetings like that. I like the way. Richard.
Did you see an evolution of Rinpoche's teachings over time?
Yes, definitely. I think a good analogy is that it's like studying mathematics or studying English literature or wanting to become a writer, say. You start with the alphabet and then you progress. And the Buddhist, you start with the alphabet, you start with the basics, and you build on it. And the interesting thing about that is you never leave the alphabet. You don't go beyond grammar. You build on it, you incorporate it, it's always there. And you need to know grammar. And you need to know how, you need to know the English language, but then you can go further with it and be creative. And so it was like that. There's a lot of development.
So not necessarily now, but as you go through cutting through spiritual materialism, can you place it in the evolution of his teaching and thinking?
Well, it was his first sort of major popular book. And the title of it was Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. It was pretty fundamental at the beginning. I think it was published in 73? Four? Sure.
Five.
Before Myth of Freedom or after Myth of Freedom? Before?
Before, but...
73?
Material was simultaneous.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's just drawn from talks. Both were drawn from...
It's pretty early on. He could have chosen a lot of different things to write a book about. It's sort of like if you don't work with that, the rest of the path can be a whole lot of spinning your wheels. A lot of activity, but not a lot of movement. Because you miss something at the beginning and then everything else is. And again, I'm not saying you resolve it or you fix it or you totally understand it and go beyond it. It's not like that. But if you're aware of it, you work with it, you realize, you pay attention.
So when Shugam Trungpa died in 78, I was 8 years old, living in the sticks in Georgia, northeast Georgia.
87.
I'm sorry, 87. So part of why I took this class is I just want to get, I mean, I have a sense of him through his writings and talks, but I was wondering just kind of what is your, if you could just kind of convey a feeling of Shugam Trungpa, what would that be?
Well, I suppose the gamut there is alien to kind uncle, from my experience. Extremely kind, gentle, caring uncle, and someone who's from outside the solar system. And a lot in between those two. He had a, I don't know if there's an adjective to do it justice, but he had a wicked, bizarre sense of humor. that went in many, many directions. A lot of them pretty raunchy at times. He liked jokes about Jews and Catholics, and he liked ethnic jokes. One of the jokes he liked was the one about Jesus is on the cross, and he's dying. He's just about gone. He can barely talk. He's mumbling something, and his disciple Peter is crawling up the wooden cross. What, my Lord, what? He gets higher and tries to get his ear up to if he can hear what Jesus is saying. He said, my Lord, what? Please. And Jesus said, Peter, I can see your house from here. And he would tell a joke over, 5-10 minutes. And to the last 3 or 4 years of his life, whenever he saw me, he would say, I can see your house from here. He wouldn't even say hello. He said, I can see your house from here. And I still have friends who say to me, I can see your house from here, Peter. He would make fun of everything, including particularly Buddhism sometimes. Pompous people, self-important people. He much preferred very, very neurotic people than self-deceived people. He would take a very neurotic person any day over somebody who thought they were together or had something. It's much more interesting, I think, for him. Much more raw meat there. Much more to work with. Very, very neurotic people. There's certain openness. And a lot of his students really, a lot of his students, as if I am outside that category. I mean, and he would engage with anyone. I was in New York City one time, driving him. For some reason, they must have been really desperate. They asked me to drive him for like 10 days in a row in New York City. And he taught continuously. And he would have me drive on the west side, the avenues, the big wide avenues go up. And he would tell me to speed. And I would kind of push it to a certain point. And then we'd screech up to his apartment where we were staying and say, we're here already? So it's only 60 miles an hour. But one night he gave a talk in the Upper West Side. It's a famous performing arts place, a couple thousand people. And it was filled. It was maybe 1,500 people. He gave a lovely talk, and I was standing kind of backstage. And he got up and started to walk off, and then he called somebody who was with him and said, please tell everybody right now that I want to talk to anybody who wants to talk to me right now. I'm going to go sit down. And so we formed a line, and it went on for probably an hour and a half, just one after another, sometimes 1 second, sometimes 3 minutes, 4 minutes. One guy came up and started. The guy apparently thought he was a dog. And this didn't faze Rinpoche in the slightest. He could easily communicate with the person. And the guy could tell that here's somebody who actually believes me. And it was like... And he sat there and sat there and sat there, and we're like, oh, God knows what time it was by the time it was done, and we had to get arrangements with the facility to extend it. I think we had to pay more. And finally, at the end, he goes like this. Is that it? Is that everyone? Other times, he would not remember the names of his closest members of his board of directors. Alien to uncle. To me, he was always like, it was more like kindly uncle, and I think probably he realized I just couldn't handle much more than that. So he was always very, very sweet to me, almost always, and gentle. And I'd see him berate other people sometimes and give them a hard time, and I realized over time, it's communication. What What are people capable of? Where do you get in and actually help them and communicate with them and help them see their own wisdom, help them work with their own confusion? But he did it in a completely there was nothing pedantic about it, or it wasn't, what's the word I'm looking for? It wasn't like he was teaching, whatever that word is. It was never like that. It was very spontaneous. In fact, I was that trip when we were in India that time, we went to Gandhi's Eternal Flame, Rajghat it's called, I think. It's where Gandhi was cremated, and they've kept a flame ever since the day he was cremated. And it's a very holy shrine. We almost didn't get in because Rinpoche wouldn't take his shoes off for some reason that I never quite understood, but he was adamant, and finally they accommodated him. And he was very reverential, and, you know, we walk around the thing, and it's a pilgrimage site, you know. Mm-hmm. They said, he said he's a great bodhisattva. And afterwards we were asking him about Gandhi. He said, yeah, no, he was really a wonderful man and a great bodhisattva, a huge heart, but he was too pedantic. And that was something he never was. He wasn't pedantic. He was crazier than that. And he seemed to have no sense of, you know, we all walk around with our little selves. And it's almost like this little, we carry, it's like four suitcases that we have to lug everywhere. And if our friends say, no, you can put your suitcases in my house and just go out and relax and have a good, no, gotta take our suitcases. Very important. It's in my suitcase, I got everything in here. We all have all these. Rinpoche didn't have any suitcases. He'd left them long, far behind. So there's a kind of freedom and lightness. He wasn't burdened, and he wasn't concerned about what people thought of him. He didn't ever gauge things on how people would think of him, which sounds simple, but if you think about it, almost all of us are very calculating in some way. And we cover things up, and we try to. It's one great thing about having kids is they see right through you half the time, and even when you try to cover it up, they're like, come on. But he didn't have any of that. It was really like he was naked. And he talked about his gurus, but one in particular. And he used that language sometimes, that he would be so intimate with his teacher that it was like they were both naked. There was no hiding, there was no maneuvering, there was no posturing. And it was just a function of being, quote, enlightened, whatever the hell that means, I don't know what it means. Because there's other teachers who are extremely realized, who really, and they're not like that, they weren't like that. So I don't know, there's something just unique about his quality. And it wasn't so lofty and so kind of, in the clouds as to be irrelevant or inaccessible. It actually really was easy to learn from. And they say that in the Tibetan tradition, maybe other traditions too, that the people who are closest to the teacher, who serve him and spend a lot of time with him, they slowly they see what is going on, and they pick it up. It's like a sniff of something, and over time it's like, oh, even without formal teaching, particularly if the teacher is very open and shares. But why he did certain things and why he said certain things and where he was, I mean, he wasn't... He was full of personality and character, but he didn't... It's sort of like the weather or something, or colors. They have their own characteristic, but they're not, they're just natural. They just kind of go by and appear and manifest. He could be really fierce, though. Really fierce. And I think usually it was if people weren't being real. Not if they weren't being good. Not if they were confused. But if they weren't being real. That would really get him going. And his job was not, absolutely not, to make people feel good. It was not to comfort people. It was not to congratulate people. He was a hard taskmaster. Although, most of the time it seemed like he, in some level he could care less. He wasn't... It's beyond category. It's beyond understanding, I think, or concepts of he cared, but he didn't care. He really cared about suffering and human beings torturing themselves. And he really didn't care. So he wasn't earnest. But he wasn't disengaged. I don't know. It was a remarkable quality of... Anyway, I hope that somewhat answered your question.
That quality of engagement and that's so attractive to me, inspiring, and you know, I think of that in terms of the spiritual teacher of Rinpoche, that's his like personal genius or something, and then I think he could have chosen to go anywhere. There's a lot of places between Tibet and here, and he chose here, and I wondered if you would comment on that.
You know, Americans are laughed at and accused, rightly so, of being an almost cultureless society. The only thing we really can claim is jazz, sort of, and baseball. It's very hard to find very many things that are actually genuinely, natively American. Some music, maybe, I don't know. But we're very young, extremely young culture. And unsettled, unformed almost. And there's something in our cultural makeup that I think he found intriguing and held a lot of potential for being open, not being cultural bound. My ex-wife grew up in Croatia, in southern Europe. And I would go there and it was like, whoa, I mean, what's... This is like so serious stuff, and the way people do things, and it was all, it's very... I found it kind of stifling. And I would never want to live there. Because there was actually forms and traditions and, you know, there's a way people do things. And look at Americans, they're so informal. And that's kind of a negative way of looking at it. But for Rinpoche, the positive side of that was that it's all kinds of possibilities there. I think. I don't know. That's a good question, a big question.
And a lot of neurosis, which he liked to work with.
Yes, although I'm not sure we had any more or less anyone else, but maybe an attitude toward it that was we were eager in a certain way. I think he could, and curious and not, I don't know, something fresh I think he saw there that more than Europe. There's another very prominent Tibetan teacher, His Holiness Karmapa, who's young now, he's like 24 or something, and he's starting to teach and travel. And they say, he talks about America all the time. And people say, what about Europe? He says, yeah, I know Europe, but then they start talking about America.
Do you think in terms of the big picture of serving the world, that America is poised somehow to do that differently than other countries?
Yeah, that's a whole other angle, that it is in some way culturally one of the most influential, obviously. So if something changes there or something, some sanity can be brought to it, that it could have a wider effect in the world maybe. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little highfalutin maybe, but maybe he saw something like that.
Thank you.
On that same question that you just raised, I go back to that time, having met him, you know, very early on, and look at what our culture was like at that time. You know, we were all spiritually extremely hungry, you know, trying to make sense of, you know, our parents and their life out of the Depression, you know, at that time, the Vietnam War, and all of this confusion that we were going through in our 20s and trying to make sense of all that. And here this teacher comes around that's just so refreshing. And it just created a fabulous relationship. So I think the culture of the times was quite important in a response for your question.
Yeah, I think it was a time of kind of cultural chaos, therefore opening, maybe. I don't know.
Couple of things. One, towards the beginning when you were talking about Rinpoche, it was kind of interesting. It was actually kind of jarring having just come back from a long, silent retreat where sometimes different memories or whatever that I had of the Vidyadhara were so vivid that it was like feeling his breath almost right there. And it was almost kind of jarring to be hearing about him as a past tense tonight. It was kind of interesting. And so I was struck towards the beginning when you said something about he died, whatever that means. The way you put it felt like it was pretty inconclusive on your part. And so I was curious what more you might say about that. And then I wanted to share something afterwards, maybe a little thing from a friend had shared with me and a student or an intern I had once who'd never met him. But I wanted to hear what your words would be about that, because I think with every person I know who dies, I go into that inquisitiveness around death once again. So, and it's particularly different in some ways with Rinpoche, so I'd like to hear.
I don't know. If I'm honest with myself, there are times when I think about him as an ordinary person who died and moved on, and I had some experiences with him, and it was wonderful. He's my teacher, and that was that. Sometimes I think it's almost like your wife dies when you're young and you never remarry, or something, that I don't have another teacher like him. And so there's a certain kind of sadness there in almost an ordinary way, no, not special sadness or spiritual sadness, just sadness. Other times, in good moments, on good days, it's much bigger than that. I was in Safeway recently, early in the morning, way too early in the morning, and I was relating to talking to the teller, and I caught myself that I was definitely not relating to her. And there was a lot of different stuff going on all at once, and I kind of saw it, and then I stopped and I did relate to her. And I thought of my teacher, that he would always relate to people. You don't blow people off, you don't ignore people, you don't get wrapped up in your little cocoon and just bustle through life. One time I was with Rinpoche, he was walking into this building, and he stopped outside on the sidewalk on this side, and he looked down and there was this trail of ants winding its way across the sidewalk. And it wasn't some humanitarian gesture, they didn't want to step on the ants. He was just struck by the ants and stood there for a few minutes and watched them. And then in his elephant walk, he proceeded to go in the building and go to his office, which was right down over here. We're so frantic most of the time. What happens between getting out of the car and walking into the Safeway is like dead time. You're lucky if you look at the sky or the weather for a fraction of a second, but you're into Safeway before you even get there, and you're out before you're out. And who cares about a teller? Or, you know, a checkout person. What difference does it make? You have business to do, things to accomplish, in a hurry. I'm always in a fucking hurry, seems, particularly when I go to Safeway. But it's a terrible way to live. And he didn't live that way. He wasn't slow. It's not just slow. He was steady and actually relate to what was going on. So, he's alive in there somewhere. He's alive out there somewhere. But how to pin it down anywhere in any way is impossible. There's not much to be said. There's not much I can say. What was your?
Oh, I like that, the not pin it down. I wonder just how you would talk about that. So I like appreciate the notion of caught by awareness on some level, reminder, alive in that sense. And then I was going to share that two things that I was remembering kind of around that and around this. You know, I was reflecting how hearing about Trungpa Rinpoche could also feel like describing a pot of gold that one will never dig up from one's porch because gold is gone kind of thing. And I was remembering two things. One is a friend a long time ago who used to work in the building as well was saying that she spent many months deliberating whether to stop working here or not. And finally she kind of told Rinpoche that she just, you know, she felt it was time for her to leave, but she couldn't bear the idea of not working with him anymore. And he said, "Oh, that's how you think you kind of are close to me or with me by working here in this building mm-hmm. for me." And mm-hmm. he was like, "Oh, it's only through practice. It's the only way." And I think she shared that with me in like 1987 or 88 at a 10-week Maitri program. And probably 88. And then later, many years later, I had an intern at the counseling service I supervise, and the intern was a Naropa student, and he had never met Trungpa Rinpoche. And I know the Vajradhara wasn't particularly keen on people's dreams and all that, but this intern had never met Rinpoche, and he was a profoundly kind person and had tremendous bodhicitta and was wonderful with clients. He was so there with people and just naked heart. And he had a lot of longing to have met Rinpoche, and he had one of the most direct, vivid experiences of the Vidyadhara in a dream out of kind of nowhere. I've never had a dream like that. it was just really stopped my mind. So I wanted to share that just in the context of this class for you too. Thank you for sharing that.
It is an intriguing question in some way. It's probably worth contemplation and curiosity. Is not so much where is he now, but what is he now? And how is he now? Because he clearly didn't just evaporate into thin air. Or maybe he did. Never mind. Can't pin it down. Maybe we should end it here. Into thin air. So, thank you all, and we'll have our second class next week when Clark will talk about spiritual materialism in more depth and terrifying detail. Thank you all.